there, and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and today I'm joined by Drs. Rod Rosenblatt, Scott Keith, and Adam Francisco. If you listen to the show, I like to change the order up of who joins me. So sometimes I go left to right. Sometimes I go completely out of order.
I must not be paying attention.
But yeah, you didn't even look at me. Rod did. Rod noticed. We're all here today to record the 8th episode in our series of the history of the Reformation. If you've been following along with the series, we are now in the very late 1520s. Today we're going to pick up in 1529 and likely get into 1530. If this is the first time you're tuning in, I know we have some new subscribers because we've been doing some advertisements on Overcast and Facebook, Instagram, and we've been getting subscribers from there. Thank you for joining us on this episode. You will likely find it helpful if you go listen to some of the earlier episodes in this History of the Reformation series. And it starts with an episode titled The Origins of the Reformation. I don't think it's necessary. You could definitely listen to these out of order and get a different piece. I've been titling them in a way that would make it so that you could just listen to one for the particular piece of information. But if you like this episode, if you enjoy this episode, you will also find the other ones useful, helpful, and informative. And if you are following the Thinking Fellows, you should go check out the other podcasts that 1517 produces at 1517.org/podcast. We have a network of 12 shows right now that is slowly growing. We're focusing less on launching new shows this year and more on sort of defining and expanding the audiences for the existing programming. So thank you for supporting that and following that there. If you're looking for more educational material in this vein too, you should go check out 1517 Academy and the new Academy lectures by Dan Van Voorhis on the history of the Reformation. It's a little different than the Thinking Fellows. You got video lectures there, and you can also take quizzes to see what you retained or what you should have, what they think you should have been learning from those. I think it's a very helpful resource, and it definitely pairs up well with what we're doing on the show right now. Okay, so to get into our main topic here, we ended with, I think, what could be sort of a light bulb moment for my father, Dr. Scott Keith, on the three estates and the third use of the law and the catechisms. And I think that was actually a really great, that ended up being a surprisingly great episode. And I think, not that the episodes aren't generally good. Well, every once in a while, I get to sit here and learn something new, which is cool.
Wow, that's very like humble that. Of you.
Oh. Every once in a while, you get to learn something new.
Today, I would like to, we talked about why, sort of the usefulness of the catechisms, but we didn't really define the difference between the large and the small catechism outside that we said that the small catechism was directed towards lay audiences. And if when paired up, the small catechism comes just like, I mean, they're published nearly the same time, but the large catechism was written first, right? And then it was Luther's large catechism and the smaller catechism. Mm-hmm.
April and May of 1529.
Yeah, so very close. But the large catechism does come first.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
So why don't we talk about the purpose, place, content of the large catechism, and then we can talk about how it differs from the smaller catechism.
Adam, I was looking at you. I mean, one of the things I tell the listeners is that this still is within the realm of the conversation regarding both the visitation articles, and the first antinomian controversy. Okay, because all of this is still going on. I mean, in fact, as early as 1525, Luther is first talking about writing a catechism, and to one of his other friends, and the name of Agricola actually comes up in that letter as a reason why a catechism has to be written. Right. So this is not something that happens right away. Luther is somewhat reluctant to be the one to write these because he's already, not because he doesn't think it's important or not because he doesn't want there to be good catechisms. He is willing to defer to others on this initially. And two, he's busy. Like, he's busy. I mean, he actually lays out in this letter where he's being asked to write a catechism saying, you know, there's other people that would be better at this, blah, blah, blah. Besides, I'm busy. I'm consumed with writing my second postol, which is a series of sermons that are already written out that can be published and handed out so that uneducated preachers can just get up and read them. I'm preparing lectures on Deuteronomy and maybe Leviticus, and he's doing all these other things. He's like, I just flat out,
I'm tired, man.
I'm tired. I don't have time. But the need doesn't go away.
Yeah. So one of the things about catechisms that's distinctly different than the works in the 15 teens, specifically disputations and theses, is that the catechisms are actually more of a humanist type of education and learning than scholastic. Melanchthon goes into very late in the Reformation, but has a catechism where the whole beginning preface that I've translated is about the instruction of catechesis and that it's a study that goes back to the Greek philosophers for Melanchthon and the process of how do we teach this essential knowledge and how are we going to structure that and do that. And so that's
So catechism is a small instructional booklet, right?
Yeah.
And so when we use the term catechism regarding Luther's catechisms, it's a small instructional booklet regarding theology, mm-hmm. as it ought to be taught in the church. But what Melanchthon does in classic Melanchthonian fashion is he kind of writes a catechism about catechesis.
I know. It's a really...
It's like...
The whole introduction is literally like, you must be able to read Greek to do this. And it's like, but if you don't know Greek, he literally says, I'm going to give you one word. And he goes, katecheo, and this is the only time I'm going to define it, to teach.
Yeah.
And it was like, and you're like, whoa.
Yeah.
this guy was intense.
Scott, you're a Melanchthon scholar.
I like
My impression
too.
Of Melanchthon is that he's a quiet... He's the quiet reformer, right?
That's the title of a book. But, yeah, he's not quiet though.
Okay, well, he's not a humble man, is he?
He's not. He's just not a blusterer like Luther.
Okay,
I mean that's a difference. It's, okay. You know, he's not. He's not the guy in the room that's probably going to attract attention at a party, but he's strongly opinionated.
You know the term humble brag? Mm-hmm. That's like that. I get that feeling when I read Melanchthon all the time because all of a sudden you'll be like, you'll be pages deep into Latin text, and all of a sudden it changes to paragraph of Greek, and you're like, with no explanation as to why or when it's going to stop, and you're like, that's just he just did that because he can.
Well, by all accounts, students at Wittenberg would have much rather been dressed down by Luther than Melanchthon, if that makes any sense.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that a dressing down by Melanchthon was
devastating.
Devastating.
Ugh. But Luther likes people.
Yes.
He's cranky, to be sure, but he likes people. He has people's best interests in mind, right? Melanchthon, is he, he thinks on the abstract level. We know
I mean, he's an academic.
I wouldn't one word I've written to be graded by Melanchthon.
You kind of can conjure in your mind, well, you went to Oxford, conjure in your mind like the picture of the most erudite academic that you knew of. And they were that way because they were usually pretty damn smart, right? Mm-hmm. They generally, when they walked into the room, they generally knew that they were the smartest person in the room. They maybe didn't like stand up on a table and say, I'm the smartest person in the room, but they knew it. And this is, I think in a lot of ways, this is Melanchthon. He defers to Luther quite a bit. And I think that deference is out of respect for Luther. But not necessarily because he thinks Luther is smarter than him.
Gotcha.
Just respect for Luther.
I took my German language exam at Oxford, and they gave me I had to translate on the fly, I had a dictionary, a letter from Melanchthon written in German.
Oh, boy.
And so I started translating it.
Where'd they find that?
After the first paragraph. Well, right. And then all of a sudden it switches to Latin Greek.
Yep.
And the Greek and Latin are mixed.
Yeah, every space.
Yeah.
And I went up to the proctor. I said, I'm here for the German exam. I'm done with the German, but there's Greek and Latin. Am I to translate that as well? And they said, I'm sorry we gave that to you.
No. Anyway,
but that's Melanchthon. Luther does this a bit too, though, where they're mixing. And you see this in places, North Africa, for example, in Morocco. Three different languages in one sentence.
Yeah, well, and with Melanchthon, he actually gets to, like, the grammar up correctly, too.
That's the thing with Melanchthon and humanists. They're doing it because they get off on it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're doing it to kind of... I assume it's a playful. They're doing it in a playful manner.
Well, I mean, even
to one up each other.
Even think of the fact that we call Melanchthon instead of Schwarzschild, right? We call him Melanchthon because in the humanist tradition, his name is changed to the Greek transliteration of his name.
Mm-hmm.
This is what humanists did.
Yep.
They were playful. There's a sense in which I'm showing you that. I've done the work by virtue even in this letter of my ability to, you know, switch between Latin and Greek and pair up the grammar, you know, and it's in a sense it's bizarre, but and I have looked at some letters of Luther where he does similar things, but it's not in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
Melanchthon go from like sentence to sentence,
mm-hmm.
you know, not just interspersing Greek words, which might have an emphasis of meaning, but he literally go from sentence to sentence.
Like,
the last page and a half has been in Latin, and the next three paragraphs are going to be in Greek. Yeah. And by the way, Attic, we'd call it Attic Greek, not Koine.
Like Homer's Greek.
Homer's Greek.
When I first hit Melanchthon's Greek, I had to get a different Greek dictionary than the one I had because it wasn't, you know, John and Paul and the epistles. It was like,
yeah. But anyway, that's just, you know, so it's not surprising then knowing that he brings it back
around.
They're
two different. So Luther's from this Augustinian scholastic culture, though he's separating himself from scholasticism. You know, he's very careful of the pull into his training because
mm-hmm.
he's a man of the people, not in some sort of socialist or populist.
No, he's a preacher.
He's conscious of his vocation.
Yeah.
Melanchthon's the abstract thinker. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. So it's not surprising.
He's in the world of ideas.
Melanchthon's catechism is a catechism on catechesis.
Yeah. He's the theoretician.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And again, you see that parallel with the Renaissance and the Reformation. Yes. Same thing with Calvin. Some people, scholars, wonder all the time what it would have been like if Luther had gotten together with Calvin. Well, you can sort of answer that by looking at what did happen, and that was Luther as colleague to Melanchthon.
Yeah. I forget which collection of, it's a collection of essays on Melanchthon, but there's a couple chapters that deal heavily with the similarities and the influence of Melanchthon on Calvin.
Melanchthon knew everybody, and that included Calvin.
Arguments from mm-hmm. influence are difficult.
Mm-hmm. Yep, they are. They are.
I'm sort of getting this, and I'm thinking about it in my own context as chair of a department at Concordia.
Oh, yeah.
And having some friends, colleagues who are in the clouds.
Uh-huh.
I'd love to be up there in the clouds with them, but there are real practical things.
Yes.
Anybody who
I wish I was in the clouds.
You know, dives and spearfishes and surfs and, you know, they're not the guy that's in the clouds.
Oh.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Unfortunately.
Drive the Jeep.
Choke people out.
So
not in the clouds.
To bring it back from sort of the tangent that I got us on, so the large catechism, who's it for?
I be careful with that.
Right.
Okay.
I was going to say that, but something like that.
Yeah. Be careful with that because the way that this comes out, and even saying that you can say that the large catechism is published before the small catechism, but that's not the same thing as saying that the large catechism was written before the small catechism,
mm-hmm.
because that's theory, and it has to do with... I believe primarily Luther's naming of the large catechism as essentially Adam German catechism is how it's originally published as Luther.
Yeah, Grosser.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, no, as I think it's as the Deutsche catechism.
Oh.
I think originally. Okay. But so we think, generally scholars think Luther wrote because of the naming and even as it becomes known, the larger or the Grosser catechism. To the smaller catechism, that it was first. It certainly published first, and that the small catechism was second. But these things are rattling around in Luther's head at the same
time. Well, like Adam said, if it really was a month apart, you have to imagine they were not totally, it's not, it can't be totally separate. If I published something a month apart, I would have been probably working on both.
It's at least in their head.
Yeah.
Well, and one of the things that sort of helps with this is just, as Luther writes about what he's doing when he's writing the catechisms, it's great. He uses the word heathens, that he's writing basically a Christian instruction book for the poor, miserable heathens. Well, who are these poor, miserable heathens? Well,
Christians.
They're the German Christians, right? And so why are they heathens? Well, because for Luther, you're a heathen if you don't know the Ten Commandments and you don't know the Creed and you don't know the Lord's Prayer. You know, you're that qualifies you as a heathen. You may be baptized, but you don't know the Ten Commandments. You don't need to know the creeds. You don't know the Catechism or the Lord's Prayer. Who knows, right?
So it's sort of like calling somebody a Philistine today.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. And then also he specifically says, you know, we need to address the horrible, miserable conditions that we found in the visitations. Then he does a little parenthetical note, you might say, that I did too, you know, where you get the indication that he was at least in some of the visitation committees that went out, and that we have to address that. So these things are banging around in his head at the same time. Mm-hmm. I do think, I'm not sure anybody's done any work on this, it'd be interesting, but I do think that the fact that he's becoming a family man around this time gives some direction to, even if he did write the larger catechism first, to have to look at it and go, would I use this with my children? Mm-hmm. You know, or could I expect a priest to use this with the children in the parish?
And that gets to who he's calling heathens, right? He's not just calling priests and ministers heathens. He's calling the general populace, you know, they do not know the Christian faith. And so then, you're right, he has to be asking, how do we get the general populace to know the Christian faith? Well, you have to hit them when they're learning, when they're children.
Mm-hmm. Well, so, and again, I want to just emphasize other things he's doing at the same time. He's writing postals. Again, these are sermons that can literally be handed to an uneducated pastor, and a pastor can literally get up in the pulpit and just read them for the sermon on Sunday. He's writing prayer booklets for how to pray. He's writing, coming out of my mind here, simple forms of worship that can be handed off to these churches. So this is heavily, heavily influenced by the impact that the visitations had on here. What do we find? We find the pastors don't know their job. They don't know how to educate. How do we answer that? Let's write them sermons so that they're not preaching heresy. Let's provide them a little prayer book so they're not actually teaching heresy as they pray.
Yeah.
And let's give them a simple form of worship so that, again, not proclaiming heresy as they go through the liturgy. And these all come together, and the last sort of block in the stack is instruction,
mm-hmm.
Christian instruction.
Without trying to stir the pot too much, you know, our seminaries today are, an attempt to avoid the necessity of this kind of, after somebody's already in the pulpit or congregations are already established, having to like go back and rip it all apart and do this.
Yeah, that's laudable.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah, I think, I mean, at the end of the day, that's kind of what I see, right?
Yeah.
Is, you know, somebody who is uneducated, as we've seen, we can make it work like they did in the Reformation. But in order to avoid sort of the whole mess of having to constantly monitor, we now try to do it preemptively.
But at the same time, let's not, I mean, the danger in our age is to be ignorant of the fact that there are churches, even our own beloved Senate, that are probably being served by people that are not educated enough to serve.
Yeah, so that's what I was going to ask. What place
and so does providing this have? These resources is a glorious thing. I mean, we should still be providing postals and simple forms of worship.
Okay.
And simple form, and we do.
That's good.
Right? In our church, and we do. These things are provided. And that's a good thing.
Yeah.
Because not everybody is, you know, at first, as Melanchthon would say, first a grammarian and then a theologian, right? This isn't everybody. And so the people that are can provide helps to these people.
That's good. Yeah, you got straight. I was going to ask the question, what place does this have in the modern church? And you went straight to it. So that's good. Okay, so.
I really like the catechism.
Me too. And I, you know, this is one of those episodes we generally only have guests on when they travel because of the way our recording set up. But this would have been a good episode to have who we've had on in the past to talk about catechisms, John Pless on to do. And he just published another book on catechesis.
He is the catechism guy.
Yeah. And so I'll actually put his now, I think it's three books on the catechism.
Praying the catechism is one, which is...
He just published another last fall. I do not remember the name of it off the top of my head, though, on catechesis.
I once heard him referred to as, in a faculty meeting, as ubiquitous. Which is a term we usually talk about Jesus.
Well, there was another
one. And
plus writes, man.
There was another one who for years, I think he's in glory now, but I think he was in the Chicago area. I just can't remember his name, but holding catechism things for our clergy. I'll have to look up that.
Oh, like catechism conferences?
Yes. Yeah. And he was himself master of it. And no wonder they said, could we come and study there under you? Because he was just master.
I would just love to encounter a pastor who thinks that they still need to study the catechism. Because, I mean, every time I crack the thing open, it teaches me something. And it's, I mean, it gives you a window into, I mean, I'll say, if you just look at the way Luther teaches the Jim Nestigan points this out, and I think it's a beautiful thing to point out that for the first time when Luther teaches the Decalogue in the small, especially in the small catechism, but in large catechism too, for the first time in, you know, basically in 1500 years of Christian history, you have the Decalogue taught in a manner that's positive. Mm-hmm. Not negative. Mm-hmm. In other words, that this is what you don't do or you go to hell.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what you do or you go to hell. But when Luther explains these things, it's explained in a positive light. I mean, great examples of that for our day, I think, are the Sixth Commandment, say, right? Which in our numbering is you should not commit adultery. Luther doesn't explain it by saying, if you cheat on your wife or have premarital sex, you're going straight to hell. This is a mortal sin. You're done. Right? Which, okay, it's a sin that God can look at you and say you're a sinner as manifested by the fact that you've committed adultery. But Luther says, what does this mean? And the answer is that we ought to fear and love God enough that when we see our neighbor, who in this case is our wife or another woman, that we discern that it's important to lead a decent life in our sexual relationships with them, in our words, in our deeds, and that this culminates in loving and honoring one another. I mean, that's a distinctly positive spin.
Yep.
An explanation of thou shalt not commit adultery that was unique in the church at this time and is. Mm. I think
still unique
in the church.
Oh yeah, uh-huh.
And gets back to Adam bringing up the three estates. Right, this is Luther dealing with the catechisms in terms the first table or the first three commandments as far as your estate in the church in relationship to God, and the last three or last seven in your estate in civil society as you deal with one another.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And lest I have a 14-year-old going through catechism right now. He'll be confirmed in I guess a month or 2 months from now. And I'm sort of I default to the Melanchthon. I wish I was in the clouds and in ideas and things. And I sometimes in my private moments critique learning by rote memorization, right? And then my son, who's 14, I don't know where he learns it from. Probably from me. He's a bit of a skeptic of all things.
Mm-hmm. I call him realist.
Okay, well, my pastor came out to me a couple weeks ago and said, because my son told me he had a quiz for his confirmation class, and I assume my son just didn't give two rips about it and failed it miserably, and not that it was great or anything, but my pastor said, wow, your son really knows the catechism. He said, really? I'm surprised, you know, because that's his face to me. That's the way he's just sort of aloof, and because he's a 14-year-old boy,
sure.
He's more interested in wrestling and girl. Well, I don't know if he's interested in girls yet, but he's been.
He's a 14-year-old boy. Yeah.
He's been. Well, I know, but he's, you know, he's been learning the catechism by rote, but it's slowly but surely seeping down into his DNA.
Yeah.
And thank God for it.
Yep.
Amen.
And I mean, even though you don't see immediate results, you might not see results 3-4 years down the road. That's the genius of the small catechism, is just learning the basics of the Christian faith.
Right.
And it becomes part of it slowly but surely part of your worldview.
Yep.
And in 1529, after the small catechism's published, Luther wrote a work called A Muster Sermon Against the Turk. I have to go, of course, to the Islamic shtick, right?
Yeah.
But this is, it's interesting. The work is, first it starts off by looking at the circumstances, because the Turks are marching, they're at the gates of Vienna.
Yep.
That's the imperial city in the east of Germany. It's in Austria. And if the Turks would have taken that, it would have been over for Christendom. Maybe. And in the Muster Sermon Against the Turk, after Luther sort of takes stock of the circumstances, the second half of the thing, he says, now I want to consider, I want to give advice for those Christians who might wind up as prisoners of war or subject to the Turks. He says, do not expect you can have a pastor or any evangelical books there. He knew enough about Islamic law, you're not going to have any of this stuff. So you need to, as he puts it, you need to learn the Ten Commandments, the Our Father, basically the first Lord's section Prayer. Of the small catechism. Yeah. You need to learn it now. Because when you get over there, you're the person. You're not going to have a pastor. You're the pastor.
Yeah.
You're the missionary.
Yep.
So learn it now. The circumstances, this is not just abstract stuff. This is, Luther is
what could become.
Living in a world where the future of Christendom is up in the air.
Yeah, the chief part.
Yeah. And I dare say, this is speculating a bit, but I don't think it's too radical. We live in a culture where everything's up in the air, and the small catechism is the thing that grounds people. That's its importance for today.
Yeah.
I hadn't seriously. I mean, I've read it in the last 10 years, but since confirmation, right, I hadn't seriously studied it. I had reread it for certain classes in school, but in the last 6 months, I started re-teaching myself it because I have children now, and Esther is just old enough where she's starting to, a piece at a time, learn lots of information and memorize stuff. And I said, I need to know what it's like to memorize this again.
My son's got at least one piece of it mounted on the wall of his house where his kids are, which is, of course, what Luther intended, that there'd be placarded. They'd be placarded on the walls of the house.
Well, we're almost done with our first poster.
Yeah.
1517 publishing. Okay. Yeah, we're almost done. It's in the works. It's been a while. It's been really hard to get artists and letterpress people and everything together on the same page to actually do it. And
well, we have so many people. We have people interested in working with us to do it later in German and in Norwegian too. Yeah. So, but I mean, it's definitely interesting to go to the Three Estates thing. When I first learned it, I was learning it as a child. So certain things, you know, are completely different to me now. Fourth Commandment, is in a much different position when you're 13 than when you're 23 and you have your own kids. And now that's why I was like, I need to relearn this as a...
Now you understand why I called it the best commandment.
As an adult who has children, who has a job, who's in a totally different stage in life than I was 10 years ago. Yeah. And it's got a different value.
You know, at one point, it was in the context of him being frustrated about something, which isn't always the case because he's actually a very kind man. But I remember talking to Jim Nest again, and it had to do again with, I don't know how they can tell me what the catechism means, but what he said, this was probably six, seven years ago now, but what he said really stuck with me. He said, I literally meditate on the catechism every morning as I'm walking my dog.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, the two things occurred to me right away is that, well, one, you're not bringing a book and walking your dog and reading it. You've got this thing memorized.
You know? Like memorized.
Yeah, but that you actually dedicate, and maybe it's more pious than I could ever be, I don't know, but you actually dedicate this time out of your day every morning to think about this thing that you've had memorized, in his case, probably for 50 some odd years by that point.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, I don't know. I mean, to ask who are the audiences, Caleb, I mean, it's an interesting question. I mean, generally, you could say in the vernacular discussion, the small catechism or the large catechism is probably mostly studied by pastors when they take their confessions course in either undergrad or in seminary, and then maybe used to, like, your grandmother, my mother. I mean, she's a very sort of influential time in her church life when her pastor offered a class to those who were interested in large catechism, right? So you might have it used in that situation where a pastor who's a good educator realizes there's a segment of his congregation that really wants to dive in deeper, and one of the natural places to go to dive in deeper than the small catechism is large catechism.
Sure.
Right? It's longer. The structure is very similar, though not 100%, but very similar.
Still not very long.
Still not very long, but definitely more meat to it than what you get in the small catechism as far as, like, pagination, more meat. There's actually more words. And the small catechism in our day and age is typically used to educate children. And that's sort of who the audience originally was, probably similar. But in our, as it plays out in our day and age, I mean, typically pastors read the large catechism and educated laity, and small catechism is used for the instruction of children.
Yep. Cool. And both of these documents later make it into what is the collection of Lutheran confessional documents, the Book of Concord. And so if you do have a Book of Concord, you can go through, and they're about halfway through. Large catechism, small catechism. They're both there.
It's also the only two things written by Luther that were included in the Book of Concord that were not heavily debated about being included. I mean, believe it or not, small call articles were, because they actually weren't adopted at the diet. The other one that was debated being in place, Bondage of the Will. But these were not debated. They were in. They actually had confessional status prior to there being a Book of Concord, much like the Augsburg Confession.
Yeah, that's sort of hugely important to later Lutheranism, and still why they're, you know, why they make it into the 20th, 21st century as part of.
Well, they not only make it into it, but as I've mentioned before, they're considered one of the great books of the Western world.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? That makes the list.
Yeah, that's not true of other Protestant catechisms. It isn't. But it is of Luther's small catechism.
So one other thing that we're going to talk about the next time we all come together and record, but starts now, is public disagreement with Zwingli, starting over the Lord's Supper and baptism. And that happens at a colloquy, starts with an M.
Marburg.
Thank you. Marburg colloquy.
Three of us are like, Marburg.
You guys are excited. Uh-huh. And so can we briefly talk about the importance of Marburg and now Zwingli? Like, I do want to do an episode on Zwingli here to sort of...
Well, stick with catechism for a second, because you can play the one in...
Okay,
in,
good.
...into the other.
Yeah,
because the way that Luther explains the sacrament of the altar, even in the small catechism, you know, sets the stage for what the debate is, right? So Luther in the small catechism says... You give it a name and choose a name, right? Sacrament of the altar, Holy Communion, Eucharist.
Lord's Supper,
right? So what is this sacrament of the altar? First line from Luther. It is the true body and blood of our Lord Jesus Christ under the bread and the wine instituted by Christ himself for us Christians to eat and drink, to literally eat and drink, right? Mm-hmm. Not to symbolically, this is what it is. It is primarily the true body and blood of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ under the bread and the wine instituted by Christ for our benefit, for us to eat and drink. That's going to be the crux of the argument. And it comes out, the argument essentially works itself out to it is.
Yeah.
Hoc yes. est. Yeah.
What does this mean?
Yeah.
Right?
Hoc est corpus meum.
Right? And Luther basically, you know, he even goes into the Small Catechism. Where is this written? And he talks about, well, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and St. Paul write of this, and literally gives the words of institution there. Take, eat. This is my body, which is given for you. This do in remembrance of me. In the same way also, he takes a cup and says, take, drink, right? This cup of the New Testament in my blood, which is shed for you for the forgiveness of sins. But then he goes on to say, to the more important thing, which actually I think often gets left out of the discussion of the argument over the is, and what is the benefit of this eating and drinking? Mm-hmm. Because, and here's where the rubber hits the road, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not just what is the thing,
mm-hmm.
and should I eat it or not eat it, but what benefit is there in eating it? And this is where he goes directly, and I think this is actually one of the things that non-Lutheran Protestants have a harder time with, okay, is this. These words, given and shed for you for the forgiveness of sins, show us that in this sacrament, forgiveness of sins, life, and salvation are given us through these words.
Are given.
Right, and then he goes on, for where there is forgiveness of sins, there is also life and salvation. That is, I think, you know, both are hard for other denominations of Protestantism and other traditions, but I think that is beyond the philosophical arguments of is. That's the problem.
Yeah, I've been arguing this lately online with a lot of people. When I just recently published an article on atonement for 1517, but I didn't. I did sort of the setup of theories of atonement and all that, but I didn't do the limited versus universal atonement thing. You know, that would have been a lot to do in one thing. But I got questions about that. And as I've been talking to people, the more I think about it, the more I actually think it is related to our differences on sacramental theology. The people who are baptized are saved. Might not be saved. No, are saved.
Right.
And they have died with Christ and they have risen with
Christ. Yep.
People who receive the supper are forgiven, are saved. Yep. Not might be.
Yep.
They've received this grace.
Yep.
And I think you can go to verse, you know, sort of the abstract verses and find the cosmos verses in John, and you can do all that. Or you can go to the sacraments,
yep.
the way that salvation is distributed to God's people.
Yep. And takes me back to my teaching at an evangelical college years ago. I introduced the section, and I said, your assignment is simple. Use any Bible helps you have or want. Just read all the verses on baptism. Mm-hmm. You don't have to do anything more.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Just read them.
That's kind of brilliant.
It's dangerous.
Yeah.
And when we got into the discussion, of course, this blessed young student, Bright, raised her hand and said, but Professor, you can't get spiritual benefits from material elements. And I said, and I said, no, you agree with me on this. She said, no, I don't. You sound Roman. I said, you do. You just haven't thought about it.
Yeah.
I said, have you or have you not bet all of your own eternal life on particular blood shed from particular Jewish veins one particular afternoon? And she said, well, yes.
That's material things. That's
eternal benefits from material.
I said, so you're on my side. You just didn't know it.
Hmm. Yeah, that's bright. That's great. That's awesome. I do love, and then Luther anticipates also what will be the debate as his last part of this on the sacrament. He does it in baptism too.
Yeah.
Where he says, because he asks the question that he knows, he asks a couple of questions that he knows are going to be asked, right? What is the benefit of this? How can bodily eating and drinking, your student's question, do such a great thing, right? And he says, well, duh. Not just eating and drinking can do this, right? But the words given and shed for you for the forgiveness of sins, these words along with the eating and drinking, connected to the eating and drinking, are the main thing in the sacrament. Whoever believes these words has exactly what they say. What is it they say? Forgiveness of sins. Yeah, answers the same question in the article on baptism. How can mere water do this?
Yep,
Well, certainly not. Mere water can't do this.
Sure.
But mere water connected to the word of forgiveness, whole different story.
And that's why, too, like when, you know, when Lutherans start counting sacraments, it gets sort of silly, because we can even do these things. Absolution is that clear promise that is there in the physical sacraments as well. And the forgiveness of sins is the key to all of these pieces. The promises that are found in the word being scripture and the word being Christ there in that moment, absolving you through the lips of another person, through the waters of baptism, or through the body and blood.
Yeah, and we'll go to this when the discussion is over assurance. Mm-hmm. And I've done that with the Reformed, and what I say is just alien to them. I'll go to, I was baptized in the name of the triune God, and just last Sunday, the pastor put into my mouth the very body and blood of Christ for my benefit, the forgiveness of sins. And other Protestants don't go there.
I love Romans 6. All who have been baptized died with Christ and are surely raised with him.
This is maybe, I think it's the same thing, but I'll sometimes say because my pastor declared me forgiven last Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it doesn't have the physical connection, which I really, the sacraments, it's an amazing benefit, right?
Doesn't confession and absolution come between baptism and the Lord's Supper and the small catechism? Yep. So, I mean, I know it's contested territory.
Yeah.
I like what Dr. Rosenblatt said at, he didn't name it, but that evangelical college, how you already agree with me on this. You just don't know.
No, it's glorious.
Yeah, it is glorious.
Yeah.
It's a,
I like that
it
a
defies
lot.
Cloud, you know, thinking in the clouds and human reason. It relies solely on the promises of God.
Yep. Yeah, that's great.
Well, we've hit episode time, but the next episode is going to presumably take the whole time. We've done one episode on this before, but we're going to do the Augsburg Confession. We're at 15:30 as of the end of this episode.
Nine episodes in?
Yeah, that'll be episode 9, won't it? Yeah, and we're to 15:30. I think this is really, I like how sort of point by point we're going through this. This is an enjoyable series for me. I've heard good feedback from listeners, so I think this is just, this has been fun for us. Last year was, the Thinking Fellows has always been sort of changing, right? We started year one with series. We did that, the Loci series, for a long time. That took over
in a garage surrounded by blackout curtains, right?
That's right.
Then we moved.
With my bike hanging behind one of them that we often bumped our heads on.
And cars and helicopters. Yeah.
Then we did the apologetics one, which again was like another 25 episodes, so another like half a year. Then we did the Great Thinkers of the Christian Church, which was, again, like another half a year. And then because we had three pretty much established series, we then started interspersing things we missed in each of those. Because it was, you know, that was one of those things as you're kind of growing, you go, oh, we could have done a better job on this episode. Or we missed this person in Christian history. Or we should really revisit apologetics, something like that. And we did a whole year of that. And it was, I think it went really well, but this is kind of fun to return to our roots of sticking to a topic for a long time and really letting that topic develop. And so it was a lot of fun for me. If you have feedback, please do contact us. You can go to thethinkingfellows.com or 1517.org. There are contact pages on there. You can ask questions to the show. All of those get directed to me. I generally answer them or disperse them to people who can answer them better than myself. Or if they're really good, we put them on the show. We haven't done a Q&A in a long time. I'm considering doing one just less frequently this year than we did last year. We did them almost every month last year. And we did have a lot of questions. I mean, sometimes I get 20-plus questions a week. This year, we're going to do them maybe quarterly. So if you do have questions about this series, I'll put those in higher priority. And then do know that I have been getting episode requests for stuff that isn't in this series, and we will eventually break some of this up to do that too. So we have had requests for an episode on why do we worship and things like that, and there's been other things that I think are great questions to do, and rest assured we will get around to those kind of topics as well this
year. I did I don't know if you're still posting those, but Theology Unscripted on that, that answers it in about 3 minutes.
We are posting, oh, that's great. We are posting Theology Unscripted videos, which are 3 to 6 minute answers to theological questions. They are going up on our YouTube channel, which is, thank you for reminding me about this, which has been completely redone. So if you go to YouTube and you search 1517, our channel comes up. If you go subscribe there, it was not until a month ago a living and breathing channel. And now it is. We're posting 3 new pieces of content a week, and we have the backlog of every conference we've ever recorded is already up there. So if you want to see something we've done at a conference, our 1517 at YouTube, or if you would like to get the, now it's 3 times a week, these Theology Unscripted videos, those are coming one at a time as well. So please go check that out. Thank you for listening to this episode